Sweat. You mean armpit tears of weakness brought about by poor deodorant choices? Say goodbye to that salty river that floweth from your underarm with Old Spice Swagger Antiperspirant. Made for 24/7 sweat protection with daily use and an undeniable smell of cedarwood and lime. Giving you the confidence you need to quit your job, move to a remote island, and spend your days frolicking with dolphins. Old Spice Swagger Antiperspirant. Shop Old Spice now.
Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All in one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Auto insurance can all seem the same until it comes time to use it. So don't get stuck paying more for less coverage. Switch to USAA Auto Insurance and you could start saving money in no time. Get a quote today. Restrictions apply. USAA.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. You're a woman now, Adam.
Why didn't you tell me?
And God made Eve from the rib of Adam. And Eve was weak and loosed the raven on the world. And the raven was called sin. Said.
Man, Argo wins Best Picture and Josh goes all Margaret White on me.
You loosed your praise of Argo on the world, Adam, and Argo praise is a sin.
I guess it is. I'll try to keep my telekinesis from ruining this year's prom. I mean, this week's Film Spotting Top 5, Movie Mother Daughters, a list inspired not by Carrie, but by our review of the new thriller Stoker, the English language debut from Korean auteur Park Chan-wook that stars Nicole Kidman.
Argo praise is a sin, Adam. Say it.
It's all ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM3. That's Shutterstock.com and offer code FILM3.
We're also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. And we're going to get two great listener recommendations right now, Josh. These come to us from a listener we're going to hear from later in the show as well, Rose Messer in Naperville. She says, "Hi, Adam and Josh. When I'm not listening to your podcast or Film Spotting SVU, I'm often listening to audiobooks. So I have a couple recommendations that are on Audible, and I think your listeners would enjoy these as well."
Her first is A Long Way Down by Nick Hornby. Most people are familiar with Hornby's novels High Fidelity and About a Boy, as those have gone on to become popular films in their own right. A Long Way Down is getting its own film adaptation this year, with a cast that will include Pierce Brosnan, Toni Collette, Imogen Poots, and Breaking Bad's Aaron Paul. The book begins near midnight on New Year's Eve atop a London skyscraper. Four strangers have made their way to the roof with plans to jump off, each for reasons they feel are compelling. But they begin talking to each other, trying to talk each other out of it, and at the same time believing their own reasons for jumping are more dire than the others. The story is funny, warm, and has great characters. The unabridged audiobook does a great job pulling the listener in, as each main character is read by a different person. I really love the book and hope the movie lives up to the material. But just in case, check out the audiobook before the movie comes out.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Nick Hornby. Clearly, High Fidelity inspired the top five we do here every week on the show. It was the book, not the movie, that actually started that. So I love hearing about another really good Nick Hornby book as I've read three or four of them. She also recommends Under the Dome by Stephen King. This is one of King's more recent novels and is quite intimidating in hardcover form, clocking in at 1,072 pages. It's about as long as an episode of Film Spotting. But the audiobook sails by like a movie or TV show you can't stop watching. And speaking of TV shows, it's coming to CBS this summer as a miniseries. I can't imagine how they will fit all the insanity, violence, and darkness into a network show, but the original novel has more than enough to offer. Essentially, it takes place in a small town in Maine. Where else? It's a Stephen King novel, which becomes enveloped in an invisible, impermeable dome. Contact with the outside world is limited. Citizens are divided about how to deal with the crisis, and vital supplies as well as medical resources begin to dwindle. Sounds a little bit like the Simpsons movie, actually.
Yeah.
The audiobook is well-read and riveting, filled with lots of creepy people as well as those few well-meaning souls that give you something to root for. Both sound really interesting. Thank you so much, Rose, for your recommendations.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/film.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We'll share our top five movie mother-daughters and play Massacre Theater and more a bit later in the show.
But first, Stoker stars Nicole Kidman and Mia Wasikowska as a mother and daughter, and Matthew Good as an Uncle Charlie that Alfred Hitchcock would be proud of.
You know, I've often wondered why it is we have children. And the conclusion I've come to is we want someone to get it right this time. But not me. Personally speaking, I can't wait to watch life tear you apart.
India, is something wrong?
Yes. My father is dead.
Richard Stoker was a family man. Taken from us by a cruel twist of fate, the reasons for which are unknown.
India. Come and say hello to your Uncle Charlie.
Hello, India.
I'm curious about what happened to my father.
Adam, both of our oldest children are on the brink of adolescence.
Don't remind me.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm in a panic about it, but I do realize that with each passing day, things for both them and us are going to get much, much more complicated.
And it's a girl for you first.
It is a girl.
I've got a boy first.
I know. I hear it's
maybe
worse.
A little bit different. Maybe,
I know.
Hopefully easier.
Well, a movie like Stoker, which has adolescence as one of its central themes, isn't exactly comforting on this point, I would say. Mia Wasikowska stars as India, an 18-year-old loner who's mourning the sudden death of her father. Her strained relationship with her mother, played by Nicole Kidman, only gets worse when her mysterious uncle, played by Matthew Good, moves in and makes himself awfully cozy with both mother and daughter. Now, on top of this sexual tension, the movie also throws in a little bit of murder, allowing for an intermingling of sex and violence that's emphasized by Korean director Park Chan-wook making his English language debut. Through much of the film, really until its final moments, I'd say India remains in this state of confusion about her own emotions, about her desires, really about what it means to be entering this world of adulthood. I'm curious if Stoker revealed anything new to you about this mystery of adolescence. Do you feel you're a little bit better prepared for what lies ahead as a parent now, or have you simply been unnecessarily freaked out by this film?
Yeah, I think it's unnecessarily freaked out. I think you're giving this movie a much more generous interpretation, let's put it that way, than I am. And I wish I could work up a lather about this film, but I have to be honest, I had the same cold, detached, morose, unimpressed reaction to it that Mia Wasikowska has in this film to just about every moment of her life. That was how I felt.
That was your face watching it,
that
dead stare.
The entire time and right after watching this movie. And forget any revelations or intellectual takeaways from it. Just on a basic entertainment level, you touched on some of the different elements in this movie. It's covering so much ground. There are so many different ways it could hook you. It's not just a family drama, but it's a chamber drama. It's a coming-of-age story. It's a psychological thriller. It's a little bit of a revenge thriller, you could argue,
sure,
which makes sense for this director, probably best known for his Vengeance trilogy. But it's also a mystery, and at times it seems to at least want to be an erotic thriller. You'd think that one of those would pay off. But Josh, for me, there was nothing propelling this story forward. I never cared to unravel the real mystery of who Charlie is. I didn't care at all where the Charlie-India relationship was heading. And I certainly never felt any eroticism. There's one sequence that comes close. There's a fantasy sequence. We come to realize it's a fantasy sequence, playing the piano. And the piano is actually going to come up in our top five later in the show a couple times as well, where Mia Wasikowska is playing and Matthew Good, her Uncle Charlie, ends up doing a little bit of a duet with her. And there's something physical about it, the way he's touching her, but also more psychological, where you see the connection they make through music and they just seem to be in sync with each other and have a certain chemistry. That's one scene that sort of gets at what I wish the rest of the film got at. But I think the film overall, the connections it makes between sex and violence are really simple and totally predictable. It goes exactly where you'd expect it to go. And I do think as well that it ultimately comes to revel in its violence in a way that is just by the end of the film, in the last 20 minutes or so, that is really grim and macabre and just really uninteresting, unfortunately. Actually, one of my favorite critics, David Edelstein, in New York Magazine, I think summed it up best with his final line. He said, "The drive in this film toward cruelty is absolute, and in this case, absolutely boring." I had the same reaction.
I think simple is the right word. I'd agree with you there. I did actually like the movie. I'm not going to go to bat for it too hard here because I'd agree with a lot of the points you're making. I do wish this had a lot more depth, a lot more interest in further exploring, especially the mixture of sexuality and violence that you reference. It's not really that interested in it beyond its shock value,
right,
is what I felt. So I'd agree with you on that. I do think you're selling it short in some other areas, though. I think it does capture adolescence in a pretty unique and provocative way in that it shows how so many lines are blurred at once. We think of it on a basic level as just being the line between youth and adulthood and where is that and how does that get blurred. But there's a lot more going on here, especially in terms of the family dynamics. I thought it was interesting how your family can be at once your protectors and also your foe. And I'm not just talking about the Matthew Good character. There's an interesting dynamic here with Nicole Kidman as the mother as well, and with the aunt played by Jackie Weaver, who makes a brief appearance. So I did like that element. And really, it does touch on the issue of sexuality at that age and how things can be confused. Now, it pushes that to an uncomfortable area, particularly in one scene. The piano scene you talk about, I think, is really good. That's where you're left with that ambiguity and that disturbing aspect of it. But it makes sense because it's evoking that truth. I would argue that the attempted rape scene, which I don't think we want to get into who's involved or any more details, but I will say there the mixture of sexuality and violence, especially the aftermath of that, and India's reaction to that experience is a little problematic because there the movie is blurring lines that it isn't really interested in exploring further. It's thinking of rape almost purely as a sexual experience with the violence melded in. It doesn't really allow for the idea of that being an abuse of power as well, which I think is an important distinction if you're going to be depicting something like this on film. And so at that moment, I do understand where you're coming from in that the movie's pretty simple.
What do you want from me?
To be friends.
We don't need to be friends. We're family.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're discussing the new thriller from Korean auteur Park Chan-wook. It's called Stoker, starring Nicole Kidman and Mia Wasikowska. And you're right, we don't want to get into that scene too much, but it is a pivotal sequence. And that may have actually been the point for me where I really started to tune it out a little
bit. Yeah, I can understand
that. Not because it was so shocking or it really confronted me with something that truly bothered me, but it was the way that characters in that scene who had behaved a certain way before all of a sudden shifted in a way that the movie seemed to need them to. And it seemed a little bit too convenient and, again, too simple, especially in the aftermath of that, where the sex and violence connection really comes through in a way that felt forced to me. And maybe that's my problem with the film overall. You can't talk about this movie without at least invoking Hitchcock. Certainly the writer here, Wentworth Miller, and the director do that. Go back to Shadow of a Doubt, the story of a young teenage girl and her murderous uncle named
Uncle Charlie.
Yeah. And there are some other elements that seem to be paying a little bit of homage to Hitchcock here. But Hitchcock left so much to the imagination, at least through the bulk of his films, maybe not by the time we get to something like Frenzy, but he left so much to the imagination. That's why it was so effective. This movie doesn't. And with its visual style, the heightened camera work and editing right from the beginning, this dark fairy tale aesthetic, it all culminated for me in a way that felt like nothing more than an exercise in psychoanalysis. Like the director and maybe the screenwriter had been studying a lot of Freud, had maybe been in some analysis themselves recently, and this became this enigmatic psychoanalytical puzzle for them to kind of fit together on screen in a way that maybe has more interest or holds more interest for them than it does for the audience, at least for me as an audience member.
I'll defend the style to a degree because I do think that was effective. I did appreciate, especially in the early scenes where India is wandering around the rural estate she lives in. It's kind of this fading older home she lives in with her mother now that her father is gone, and she spends a lot of time alone just wandering about. It did have this air of a rotten fairy tale, which I liked. And the stylistic touches, the surreal touches that Park gives, especially that one scene where they're preparing a cake or something and she's rolling the egg back and forth so that it gets more and more cracked. I just thought those were effective touches to establish that mood. Wasikowska's costumes were really effective to me in that they had this prim, anachronistic look where they were almost from an earlier era. She was great wearing costumes in Alice in Wonderland, too. I think this is those
you
were
can't
really
help but think about that movie
costumes.
As well.
Yeah, this is a much better movie than that one. But I did like the fairy tale approach, and it was interesting to me when we suddenly shift to an actual high school, a contemporary high school. That was really jarring to me in a good way, where suddenly I realized, okay, all of these imaginary issues she's dealing with are taking place within the real world.
Yeah,
and I thought that was effective because she has to deal with these boys who are harassing her in her class. It does ground it, and I appreciated that aspect of it.
Yeah, I don't know what Freud says about a lot of things. I haven't studied Freud, so I was probably even wrong in linking sex and violence to him. But I wonder what Freud says about shoes. Particularly black and white shoes.
A lot of shoes here.
Because there are a lot of shoes in this movie. I am with you, though, on the style being ultimately a strength of this film in terms of being something that made it watchable and something I would probably even go back and watch again just to take in some of those moments. You talked about the one with the egg. I've got one or two of those as well I'll mention. But you are at least watching here a filmmaker with a vision, with a style, making bold choices.
I'd rather
watch that any day of the week than something else that maybe hits more conventionally satisfying notes. You've got discontinuity editing. You've got matches on action that sometimes match past scenes, present, future scenes, things we've seen, things we obviously haven't yet. The camera seems to be very often in motion, a little bit shaky at times. It maybe reflects India's own imbalanced point of view. And there's a scene later where Matthew Good says something about their connection, that they have these acute senses, that they can maybe hear things and see things about the world around them that other people don't. And that clicked right away because we see that right from the beginning of the film in terms of what the director is doing here. It's a little bit like Kiarostami we talked about last week with Like Someone in Love, where it forces you as a viewer, because of that aesthetic, to be very aware of everything that you're taking in on screen. You start listening to every sound that's emanating from the frame. In the frame, off the frame, you're paying attention to everything you see or don't see, and maybe even those unspoken words between the lines as you're taking in the dialogue. And for me, the key moment where that style really comes through in a playful way is where we see Uncle Charlie get out his belt for the first time. Yeah. Let's just leave it at that. The director really lingers on that. It's the longest belt you've ever seen a man wear. And
that's because it's the father's, and it's bigger than
his. They do set that up, that he was a bigger man.
That's key.
Yeah, it is. It makes it a little bit more believable, but the way he pulls it off, and you hear every sound of the friction of the threads of the jeans and the belt coming together, that's all really heightened in a fun way. I'll also never use a pencil sharpener the same way again after seeing this film.
That's a great shot. That's the kind of shot you're talking about being the hands of a visionary and a stylist that's added that you wouldn't get in a far lesser film made probably of this screenplay. Perhaps that insert is in the screenplay, but it certainly stands out, and it's just that extra touch to bring what's going on to make it a little bit more disturbing. There's another one that I just love, which is ostentatious. It's showy. It's not really necessary, but I don't care. I love it. The combing of Kidman's hair that suddenly transforms as we're looking at the long blonde reddish hair transforms into these reeds for a hunting scene.
That's one of those really beautiful match cuts that comes out of nowhere.
It comes out of nowhere. It's not needed. And a lot of times I'm critical of that sort of showiness, but I didn't care here. I thought it was a great touch.
It seemed appropriate. At least it seemed consistent with the rest of the film and not just an ostentatious touch thrown in to wow the audience. What about the cast? I've got mixed feelings about the cast, as I do about the film as a whole, which maybe makes sense. I love Mia Wasikowska. I've always been a big proponent of her work. I guess, though, I would say that you might get a lot more out of this film if you do take some pleasure in watching two co-stars acting with each other in most scenes. And it's really Matthew Good and Mia Wasikowska. We drew our inspiration for our top five from the mother-daughter relationship, but they have many more scenes together, I believe. But you've got Mia doing basically her apathetic Daria routine, for people who remember that MTV show from the late 90s, and Matthew Good doing this bug-eyed pseudo-Starman. He's almost like an alien discovering the world for the first time, which
I
actually kind of makes sense.
I thought it was great.
It kind of makes sense the more you learn about him, but if you enjoy watching conversations between those two types of people where they end every time with awkward pauses and one person scowling and the other person smiling deviously, you'll love Stoker. Yeah. You didn't do much for me.
She's the balance, because good is huge. Kidman's giving a big performance too. And we have Weaver, who we've discussed before, likes to act
much more subdued here than Silver Linings Playbook.
But it's still a big part that she gets, and she plays it to the hilt, her few scenes, I think, anyways. And so Vasikovska is the balance to that. She's the subdued one, and I think the movie really needs that. Good is a hoot. And the reason I can't quite go all the way to say that he's bad good is because he still scared me. He didn't for me.
I never felt creeped out at any point in this film. That's my problem with it.
There's something about him that's almost serpentine, his look. And I thought that even when he was playing something like the cuckold in Match Point, where he was supposed to be kind of the charming Englishman and not much more, there was always something just a little devious about him.
Yeah.
And he just plays that up here in scenes
maybe
like the
Bell. Yeah, maybe too much, Josh.
But I think it matched the heightened visual style. I think it made for the florid sense. I mean, this movie really could have been, it's verging on camp in a lot of ways.
It is, and yet I never really felt like it had a sense of humor about itself.
Well,
I felt like it took itself way too seriously.
That's why it would be camp.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think that Vasikovska is there, and her performance does keep it from going out in that direction. I might have enjoyed it just as much if it had gone way out there, but I think it's a different film and a fairly good one because of what she brings to it.
See, I don't think you're giving Nicole Kidman enough credit. I actually think that she maybe gives the most pitched performance in the movie. You've got Good going so far one way. You've got Mia Vasikovska going so far the
role,
other way.
Though.
But that's my problem. Yes, I don't think that's her fault. I think she does a lot with what she's got, where she is playing a slightly heightened character, but everything does seem to be couched in real raw emotions. I think she brings emotions out of moments that really probably aren't there, or that a lesser actress probably wouldn't pull off. But that's my big issue. You said it, is that just like the movie as a whole, there's just not enough substance to that character to really dive into. That's Stoker. It's out now in limited release, including right here in Chicago. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. Do it in your best bug-eyed Starman voice. That's what I want to hear. Also, find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Up next in Massacre Theater, we get to speak Adam's favorite language, fantasy. Plus, we'll lay out the plan for our upcoming Max Ophuls Marathon. Stay with us.
Folks, we just want to jump in for a second here to mention our sponsors again, including Shutterstock, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's your website or you're doing an advertisement or any kind of multimedia presentation. They've got clips in a variety of formats, and most of them come in HD. They source video clips from all over the world and photos as well. I think they have something like 20 million photo options, and they add 10,000 video clips each week. So anytime you go to the site, you need to find something. They've got something new for you to choose from. They also have excellent customer service with dedicated reps and 24-hour weekly support. And they have flexible pricing, so you can choose between individual clips if you're just looking for one or two and that's all you need, or if you need a video pack.
If you're interested in giving Shutterstock a try, you can do it today just by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM3 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM3. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Film Spotting.
And just one other note about Audible this week. We are brought to you, as we are often and will be throughout this year, by Audible, and you can sign up at audiblepodcast.com/film. They are recommending the book All the Rave, The Rise and Fall of Sean Fanning's Napster. This is the inside account of that file-sharing revolution that really did turn the music industry on its head. It's all about family betrayal, the mismanagement, the greed, everything that goes into that story. And it's one, frankly, Josh, I never considered that I would be that interested in. But the more I've read about it, the more I actually think it would be worth checking out. This is a 10th anniversary release of All the Rave. It's been out of print for a while. So if you have any interest in the music business or you're just into stories of betrayal and greed, All the Rave might be for you. Again, you can learn more at audiblepodcast.com/film.
How hard could it be to kill a wicked witch?
Hard. Really hard. It's very, very hard to kill a wicked witch. And what about that poor girl back there? I think she really liked you.
She'll get over me. They always do. She's a pretty young witch. There'll be plenty of wizards knocking at her door.
Oh, every lie you tell gets us one step closer to the Emerald City dungeon.
And don't think of them as lies. Think of them as stepping stones on the road to greatness.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Josh, I think the whole world has been wondering, when are we finally going to get to see a film with Zach Braff and James Franco?
Yes,
together?
I have been.
And finally, that dream is going to come true, as you hear there in that scene from Oz the Great and Powerful, the new film from director Sam Raimi. We'll talk a little bit about that movie as we get to our poll question a bit later in this segment. Right now, though, it's time for two great actors in their own right.
Us, right.
Do a little massacre theater.
We perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
Why do you want me to go back to my parents? I mean, they hate me. Why do you think I split in the first place? There ain't nothing there.
Yeah, but you can't live like this. It's a hell. A girl should live at home.
Didn't you ever hear of women's lib?
What do you mean, women's lib? You're a young girl. You should be at home now. You should be dressed up. You should be going out with boys. You should be going to school. You know, that kind of stuff.
God, are you square?
Hey, I'm not square. You're the one that's square. You're full of shit, man.
That was Jodie Foster as Iris and Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle from 1976's Taxi Driver, directed, of course, by Martin Scorsese from a script by Paul Schrader.
Rose Messer from nearby Naperville, Illinois, wrote in with the tie-in. Actually, many tie-ins that, as usual,
she did a lot of work.
She did a lot of work. God bless you, Rose. The movie is Taxi Driver, and there are a number of tie-ins. First of all, and most obviously, Jodie Foster's character is a prostitute, and so is the main character from your film review last week, Like Someone in Love. Additionally, the score of Taxi Driver is by Bernard Herrmann, who also scored North by Northwest, a movie discussed in your top five on that episode. A more tenuous connection, you mentioned Nick Nolte's performance in Affliction during your segment about Oscar Scars, and Taxi Driver shares a screenwriter with Affliction, Paul Schrader. Speaking of Oscar Scars, Taxi Driver lost Best Picture to Rocky, which seems pretty wrong to me.
That's a bad one.
That's a bad one. And I was going to make that connection if a listener didn't, because it did go back to our Ask Film Spotting segment last week, where we were rehashing the Oscars a little bit. And it's not something we were thinking about specifically when we picked that scene from Taxi Driver. But it is true that Taxi Driver was from that great class of films in 1976, along with All the President's Men. I want to say one of my favorites, Network, was 76 as well.
That
they all lost
right, yeah,
to Rocky. And I like Rocky. I really do. Don't get me wrong.
That's
I like
okay.
Rocky 2 as
you
well.
You can say if you don't like Rocky.
No, I like it.
The
it's
masses will come after you, but
it's a good film.
No way.
I think Rocky's a legitimately good film. You're the guy who picked Rocky 6 for a top five
Rocky
once.
6 is a good film.
It's not a better
Rocky's,
film than
oh,
Rocky.
Oh, it's so much more interesting than Rocky. There's so much more going on to it than the pure, obvious formula of Rocky.
I don't even know how we can go on. This is really going to raise the tension level in Massacre of Theater.
If you want to hear that scene
and our top five unseen characters, along with our review of Like Someone in Love from last week, you can find that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Josh, reach into the Film Spotting hat right in the middle, not too full, not very empty, and pick out this week's winner.
That would be Dan Wessler from Freeport, Illinois.
Congratulations, Dan. I think he's the guy, Josh, who also wrote in saying that he wished we had gone for more of a Jodie Foster, Robert De Niro impression.
I saw that, and you were dead on with how De Niro plays that scene.
I don't do actor impressions. I'm trying to be the character.
Oh, is that what you're doing?
I wasn't doing a De Niro. I was doing Travis Bickle.
Whatever your method is, it really worked, because that surprised me, too, watching that scene, how he does play it, kind of whiny and low-key. He's not the psycho there.
I think another listener mentioned it. It's almost like the guidance counselor in high school he's trying to be a little hipper than he is.
That's
me, basically.
You're on a roll with
that
really good Massacre Theater performances.
Just wait till we get to this week's. Again, congratulations, Dan. Email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
And that does bring us to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
Now, we typically like to be pretty vague with our hints here or in giving too much information about the connections, why we picked this scene. This week, we may need to spell it out a little bit.
Because we couldn't remember ourselves.
We couldn't remember. It ties back to Park Chan-wook and the film we reviewed, Stoker, being his English language debut. Though I don't think that's the obvious connection people are going to think about when they hear this scene. People are probably just going to know it because this film may be a beloved film for them, and
I think for
either
some people
know it or
it
don't.
Is.
Yeah, some people it may be. Let's get into the scene. I don't know if either of us are ready for this performance. I think
this is a challenge.
You've been preparing for this performance, knowing your go-to voices. I think you've been ready for this for a while.
It's all led up to this?
I think so.
Oh, wow.
No pressure, though, Josh. You're going to start it off. I'm going to give you the action.
All right.
And action.
Hey, look. Like big, good, strong hands, don't they? I always thought that's what they were. Oh, my little friends, the little man with the racing snail, the nighthawk, even the stupid bat, I couldn't hold on to them. The nothing pulled them right out of my hands. I failed.
No, you didn't fail. I'm the one who failed. I was the one chosen to stop the nothing, but I lost the Auron. I can't find my luck dragon, so I won't be able to get beyond the boundaries of Fantasia.
Listen, the nothing will be here any minute. I will just sit here and let it take me away, too. Hey, look, thy good, strong hands, don't they?
And scene.
Are we out of time now? Did that take too long?
The show's over. That was actually an hour. But well done, Josh. Can you go on after doing that voice?
I think so.
That may have
give me a little water.
Scratched up
I'll
your throat
fine.
A little bit. Wow. That was fun. That was definitely fun. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. I'll give you a hint. It wasn't Young Frankenstein. Even though it sounds a bit like it, it's not.
That's true.
Our email is feedback@filmspotting.net, and your deadline is Monday, March 11th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I'm retired, Oliver. You fired me.
The thing is, some time ago, before Control died, he came to me with a similar suggestion. That there is a mole. He never mentioned his suspicions to you?
No.
Oh, I just thought that just you were his his man, so to speak.
What did you say to him?
Well, I'm afraid I thought his paranoia had rather got the better of him. He's going to put his whole house down. That bloody mess in Budapest.
We all have bloody messes in Budapest in our past, don't we, Josh?
This is true.
That's Simon McBurney. And, of course, Gary Oldman is George Smiley in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. And we did mention English language debuts. That was our poll question last week, looking ahead to our discussion of Stoker on this week's show. We asked you which of these directors had the best English language debut. And we'll note again that we didn't want to really get into some of the more well-known legendary filmmakers like Roman Polanski and Antonioni and many others who have made that transition and made it well. We wanted to focus on filmmakers really over the past couple decades to try to narrow it down a little bit. And we gave you these choices. The director of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, Tomas Alfredson; Alejandro González Iñárritu for 21 Grams; Michael Haneke for Funny Games U.S.; Ang Lee, Sense and Sensibility; Fernando Meirelles and his film The Constant Gardener; or Nicholas Winding Refn for his movie Bronson. Of course, he recently worked with Ryan Gosling to great success in Drive. So those are your choices. Josh, how did it come out?
Well, in last place, and I don't know if this has to do with the fact that people agree with me and don't really like the film,
they don't
or
agree
just
with
haven't
me.
Seen it, but Funny Games, only 6%, although The Constant Gardener from Fernando Meirelles, only 7%.
That
so they
does
were close
hurt,
there.
Though. That hurts
really?
That beat out Haneke.
Oh.
That cuts me deep.
Wow. In the middle here is 21 Grams with 13%. Nicholas Winding Refn's Bronson received 18%. Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility, 20%, which means the winner was Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, 36% of the vote.
Yeah, really ran away with it there a little bit. We heard from Michelle, who says, I guess no one liked Funny Games as much as I did. Easy number one choice for me. Thank you, Michelle. I'm surprised the utterly dull and incomprehensible Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy is winning, she
That's
says.
A little harsh.
That's harsh, but not totally wrong.
Really?
It's
I thought you
totally
liked that
wrong.
Film.
No, I was right in the middle on
oh,
it, actually.
Oh, okay.
There were things I really respected about it, and I loved talking with the director, Tomas Alfredson, who made his first film, was a great one, the Swedish movie Let the Right One In. Really talented filmmaker. A lot of elements I like about the film, but no.
It's certainly purposefully
it didn't really
slow.
Hook me.
I mean,
yeah,
I could see why someone would consider it dull. I enjoyed it quite a bit, though. Terry wrote in to say, I might have went with Ang Lee if you had mentioned The Wedding Banquet. That was his first English language film, although it has some Mandarin. It is set entirely in New York City. I found the film to be profoundly moving and well-written, and as a gay flick, I prefer it to Lee's Brokeback Mountain. Instead, I'll go with a huge omission of Leon the Professional, which is Bassan's best film and a favorite of my then 13-year-old self.
That's a good film. So we left out The Professional, and we also, it seems, went with the wrong Ang Lee movie, An Intern is Going to Get Fired.
Is that what happens?
That's all I can say. If we had
easy
an intern,
to say when there's no interns.
Exactly. We also heard from William Skellern in Suffolk, UK. He says, my instinctive choice was Winding Refn for Bronson before dredging up from the fog of my memory that he directed Fear X, starring John Turturro first. Again, another screw-up by us. Clearly an overlooked film and worthy of searching out. I had to look this up. It turns out he did make this film. It does star John Turturro. It's some kind of psychological thriller. I had no concept that this movie existed.
There goes another intern.
Another intern. Thank you, William, and all of the listeners who commented and voted in last week's poll. We hope you'll go to filmspotting.net and participate in this week's poll question. And as we teased earlier in the show, we are going to discuss Oz the Great and Powerful next week. We considered asking a poll question, gauging your interest in that film. Your choices were going to be, was it the director, Raimi? Was it the cast? Was it returning to Oz? Or was it nothing? Just real quick, Josh, what was your answer to that poll
Raimi.
Question? See, I had to really be honest about it. My answer was nothing.
Oh, boy.
I'm not.
This is going to be a fun discussion.
I'm not remotely excited about it.
Is this going to be The Hobbit all over again?
It might be. I'm going to go in with an open mind. I will.
Okay.
I'm just saying, I'm not excited to enter
okay.
the theater.
All right.
And I can't change that. Instead, though, we were thinking about a director I was thinking about a lot, and we mentioned his film back during our discussion of Stoker. It's really hard not to think about Alice in Wonderland during that movie. It's hard not to think about Mia Wasikowska as a Winona Ryder-type character, someone who seems straight out of a Tim Burton movie. And we were thinking about Tim Burton in relation to Oz the Great and Powerful, Sam Raimi, because there are some connections there.
Yeah, they're sort of similar filmmakers, these 80s weirdo visionaries, you could describe them as being. And they both were given big franchises, Batman and Spider-Man, of course, so their careers follow that trajectory a little bit. Burton's biggest hits have been reimagining famous movie worlds like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and, like you mentioned, Alice in Wonderland. So Raimi does seem to be doing the same thing with Oz. It does feel like a project Burton might have taken on, and we'd probably all be worried about it
yeah.
at this point.
Or I'd maybe be more interested in it, frankly, but That is the context for this poll question. The question is, if only one of these directors could continue making films, who would you pick? Is it Tim Burton or Sam Raimi?
This was really hard when I first read it, but when I sat down and pulled up their filmographies, the answer was clear for me. I do like Raimi quite a bit, but there probably isn't a single one of his films that I like more than probably 8 Burton films.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah,
so
it does.
I'd have to say Burton, even though I know people are down on him, probably people who haven't seen Frankenweenie or just judging by Dark Shadows and Alice in Wonderland. For me, clearly Burton, though.
Yeah, it's clearly Burton for me as well, and I'll be really curious to see if we get some opposition to that. I feel like Burton's going to run away with this one, though, maybe just because of the strength of some of those other films, whether he's had a little bit of a down period lately. And I'm with you. I like Frankenweenie quite a bit as well, but I can't help but think about Alice and Dark Shadows and a few others. Raimi just has been off the radar for a while now, and as much as I really do adore the first Spider-Man and the second Spider-Man, and come to think of it, now I'm going to talk myself out of it. I really like the Evil Dead movies, too. And Army of Darkness?
You want to go with Raimi?
Gosh, I may want to switch to Raimi. That's never happened. I think that's a first in the history of film spotting. I just talked myself into a different answer during a poll.
That was fascinating to watch.
I bet. I bet I'm like a character with a split personality,
yes,
from one of their films.
Pretty much.
Well, we really want to know what you think now. Go to filmspotting.net and vote now in the poll. It's right there on the right side of our main page. Also at filmspotting.net, you can click on apps. It's a link right at the top. Get more information about our bonus content we share 99% of the time anyway. You can get it if you have the Film Spotting Android app or our iOS app. It's just a little bit of extra audio. Our plan this week is to share some of your feedback on our recent Valentine's Day top 5 romantic gestures. Got a lot of really good cinematic romantic gesture responses. I also wanted to throw out just a quick note to listeners that it's been a long time since we've gotten a good batch of voicemails.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
This being an audio show, we love to include your audio, and it's really our fault because we don't emphasize it enough. We haven't been featuring them much, but really over the past month or so, we haven't had that good voicemail. We love to come into a top 5 with a great pick from a listener.
Right.
And the number is 206-203-2463. A lot of people ask why it's a Seattle-based number. That's just the free service we use. That's what we got.
That's a boring reason.
Yeah.
You should have made up something a little more like spy or intelligence, you know?
I have a twin brother who lives in Seattle. And
I think were just talking to him in that poll.
I was, actually. I was channeling him anyway, certainly. But that's our number, 206-203-CINNA. And leave us a 30 to 45 second pithy voicemail on whatever you want in response to our show, and it just might be featured during the show. So wanted to throw out a plug for that. We also wanted to preview next week's show. We are starting our Max Ophuls Marathon, and it occurred to me as I was looking ahead to this segment on the show and mentioning Ophuls that I was sort of taking for granted that people out there listening know who Max Ophuls is, care about who Max Ophuls is, without really considering the fact that just 6 months ago or so, I really didn't even know that much about him. He was a name. He was kind of a legendary cinematic figure.
Yeah, you knew the name, but maybe couldn't even place the titles.
No,
or I was in the same position.
I don't think I could have named one of his films
right
about 9 months ago. And that's part of the reason why we chose to do a marathon on Ophuls. But I thought we would try to give people a little bit of ammunition specifically to get interested in this marathon, mm-hmm, if you don't already have that interest. And we're going to watch 4 movies from the director who really made his best work, it seems, from the late 40s to the mid 50s, both in the U.S. and then going back to France. Here's why you should care about Ophuls if you don't already. Overall, if you go back to that 2012 Sight and Sound list of the best films ever, according to the critics and directors, it happens only once a decade. 9 of Ophuls' films got at least 1 vote in that Sight and Sound poll. And one of the films we're going to watch that came up on Michael Phillips' top 10 list
of all time,
was 93rd on the critics' list. It's The Earrings of Madame Du. And that's a film I've seen because I watched it in preparation for that list. And it's a really wonderful movie. And I can't wait to revisit it here as part of the marathon. Also, he was a huge influence on Paul Thomas Anderson. PTA does an introduction on the DVD for The Earrings of Madame Du, and specifically the long tracking shots that you get in PTA's work. You really see that in this elegant style that Ophuls really kind of pioneered, or at least made part of his trademark. So if you're into PTA, and I know a lot of our listeners are, that should be incentive to watch.
We're going to start with Letter from an Unknown Woman next week. Now, that's the only one that's not available via Netflix. Here's a tip. we have a local connection. Debbie, my wife, works
yes.
at a public library. Don't forget about the public libraries,
yeah.
folks. That's where we found it. It was no problem. Got a hold of a copy there, the Blu-ray, actually. So if you're having trouble finding it, that may be one outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all the others are going to be available rental Netflix or at Amazon.
Yeah.
Right?
So you can find it somewhere. And I think maybe even Hulu Plus has all of them, but definitely Netflix if you want to get in that kind of traditional by mail route. And even though that movie was a little bit harder to find, it had to be part of this marathon. And we're going in chronological order here because going back to that Sight and Sound list, 11 critics and 6 directors, including a director I love a lot, Guy Maddin, had it in their top 10, and it did rank in the top 250 on both of the lists. So it's a fairly revered movie, and we had to have it as part of this marathon. So that's a little bit of background as to why we're going to devote at least 4 shows to Max Ophuls, and hopefully you'll be on board. We love getting your feedback every week in response to our shows. We often do include that in our reviews as we're setting up a movie for the following week. And if you want to get that full rundown of the movies we're watching, just go to filmspotting.net and click on marathons.
Adam, I was very careful to clear the studio of all wire hangers.
Thank God.
So I think we're ready to share our lists of the most memorable movie mother-daughters. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Trying hard to breathe. Head between my knees. Take my hand and squeeze. Say I'm all right.
If you're one of those listeners out there, and we know there's a few of you out there who doesn't typically enjoy the donation segment, this segment's for you. It's short and sweet this week. No long
in
emails, even though we love those emails and we love hearing from our listeners, and that's why we like to feature their comments. But yes, we will be pretty quick this week. Before we get to those names, we did want to mention MoviePass, been a partner of the show here since, I think, November. I love using my MoviePass card and my MoviePass app. You get to see unlimited movies in theaters nationwide for a flat monthly subscription rate. All you have to do is go to moviepass.com/filmspotting and use the offer code filmspotting, and you'll get $10 off your first month. So you can't re-see movies. You can only see one movie with the MoviePass. But just think about that. If you go to 6 movies a month, basically, and I know a lot of people do, and actually 6 is being way too generous. If you see 4 movies a month, you've more than paid for that monthly subscription to MoviePass. So it's something we highly recommend checking out. Again, moviepass.com/filmspotting.
We also want to make a quick note about the music on this week's show. It comes from Sharon Van Etten's Tramp, which was named a top 20 album of 2012 by The Village Voice. She's starting a U.S. tour this month. She's going to be opening for Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, so not a bad show there. She'll be coming to the Chicago Theater, actually, on April 1. In the first break, you heard Serpents from Tramp, and we just heard We Are Fine.
Let's get to our donations then. We start with a new gold-level donor.
That would be Peter from Lenoir, North Carolina.
He's been a donor before, I'm sure. And a new $5 a month subscriber.
Steven from Calgary, Alberta.
We have two new Silver Club donors, including
Mark from Dallas and Leo from Yarraville, Melbourne, Victoria.
He is a repeat donor there, Leo from Australia. Thank you so much to Leo, Mark, Stephen, and Peter, and to all of our monthly donors, whether it's $2, $5, or $10. You are, we say it all the time, but you are the lifeblood of the show, and we just can't thank you enough for your generosity. One other quick plug, as we usually do in this segment, the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. If you're not already a listener and you're looking for other great film content out there via podcast, it's a show to seek out. You can find a direct link in the notes for the show at filmspotting.net, or just do a search in iTunes for the Q&A. He also has an iPad app for his magazine Backstory, which you can find out more about at backstory.net or in the app section of iTunes.
This is Ryan Johnson, the writer and director of Brick, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
I got some good news.
What's that?
Well, I'm officially pregnant. I mean, we haven't gotten the test back yet, but you know me, I'm never late.
Well, no, I don't understand.
If you're not happy for me, I'm gonna get so mad if you're not happy.
Why should I be happy about being a grandmother?
You're listening to Film Spotting. Our top five this week is movie Mother Daughters, inspired by our discussion of the new thriller Stoker. And I don't know how you can talk about famous movie mother-daughter combos without talking about Terms of Endearment and Aurora and Emma, Shirley MacLaine and Deborah Winger there from that James L. Brooks film. Unfortunately, I think that's the only love it's going to get in this segment. It's not one I really strongly considered for my list, Josh.
It's easy not to talk about it if you only have vague memories of possibly being brought to the theater to see it with your parents. I think that's where it lies for me, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it's one I've just sort of picked up over the years and never really sat down and given a whole lot of time to. But those performances are very good. And before we get into our list, we want to touch on a few other picks that may not get a lot of love but are worthy of mention. These come to us via Twitter. You can find us, of course, at Film Spotting, but we've been throwing out hashtags for our top five so people anticipating our list can chime in, try to steer us in the right direction.
Do our work for us.
Exactly. We love that. And we do rely on you sometimes to remind us of something we would have otherwise overlooked. And this week's hashtag is simply movie mother daughters, all one word. We got some great entries already, as I said, Josh, including this one from Kyle Brown, who said Jodie Foster and a young Kristen Stewart from Fincher's Panic Room. David L. Williams said, got to go with Chris and Reagan McNeil from The Exorcist. That's one I definitely considered. And yes, we teased it earlier, but how do you not mention Joan Crawford and Christina from Mommy Dearest? That's a favorite of a lot of people, at least a camp favorite for a lot of people. And we heard from CM Gardner as well with a pick here. I almost don't even want to say it, just in case there's someone out there who has actually never seen this film. But that's kind of ridiculous because it's from the 70s. There's a certain Pantheon movie that we heard from a lot of listeners said, oh, if you're going to talk about mother daughters, you got to mention this film. But no, you really don't. That's not a key
You think this is
film.
this is a spoiler to you to say this now?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a spoiler so much as I just don't think it actually really fits. We're thinking of a certain classic Roman Polanski film where it's more of a gotcha surprise moment than being a
it's not a central
aspect of the film.
Relationship.
No, it's not.
For the majority of the film. I'd
That's
agree
what
with
I'm
that.
Saying. So we're just going to leave it at that. But we got some other choices as well that came to us via Twitter.
Yeah, Emily suggested Eve and Joey from Interiors.
A Woody Allen film, his first riff on Bergman, or at least his first blatant riff on Bergman. It's a good pick.
Emily added her own hashtag for that one. Depressing.
So yeah.
Probably applies. Skepacabra suggested Lisa and her mother, who definitely has cancer, in The Room.
I love that one.
Have you seen The Room?
Oh, yeah. We reviewed it here on the show, actually.
You reviewed The Room?
Yeah, we did a listener's choice, I think. It got picked. And I'm really glad I saw it. That's all I'm going to say.
Still have to catch up with that one. Lastly, we heard from Miguel Ian Rea, who suggested Diane Ladd and Lauren Dern as Marietta and Lula in Wild at Heart. I know you like that one.
I do like that film. I like Lynch a lot. His bizarre take on The Wizard of Oz. So I think we've covered all the bases in terms of the films you have to mention, absolutely, if you're going to talk about movie Mother Daughters. But we still have some great picks here on our own list as we get into the top five. So, Josh, what is your number five?
Yeah, let's get right to it.
Or I should say, who is your number five?
My number five would be, and it's a recent film, a recent relationship, maybe too recent for a top five. I don't know if there's a rule about this, but Princess Merida and Queen Eleanor from last year's Brave. I know that you and I liked it, but for a Pixar movie, you could almost say that this was overlooked. I'm sure it did fine in the box office. I don't really remember, but it didn't receive the usual attention that a Pixar film gets. It does begin as this familiar exercise in anti-princess girl power as Merida, who's this daughter of a Scottish king, she rejects her tradition-appointed suitors. There are three of them, by one-upping them in this archery contest.
I am Merida, and I'll be shooting for my own hand.
What are you doing?
Merida!
Curse this dress!
Merida, stop this! Don't you dare loose another arrow! Merida, I forbid it!
So we've had these sorts of parent-child conflicts in animated stories before, but the movie does take this dramatic narrative twist shortly after that, which I'm not going to give away, but it does force both Merida and her mother to reconsider their perceptions of each other in a truly magical way. I really liked where this movie went. And I'll even admit, their reunion at the end of the film, which is fantastical and an action climax at the same time, got me a little teary. It's really moving when they do have that moment together. I don't know that Brave is one of Pixar's best. It feels just a little different in a lot of ways than other Pixar movies. But the way it does focus on this mother-daughter relationship, I think it stands apart in a crucial way from a lot of Pixar stuff, a lot of Disney stuff, especially that tradition of parent-child dynamics that Disney deals in so often.
Yeah, I like Brave, as you mentioned, and it's one I did consider. Not quite an honorable mention, but it is a movie I considered for this list. I didn't really come up with any fancy criteria for my top five, but I did think about the fact that that relationship had to be central to the story. It couldn't just be, and we talked about this a little bit with that Pantheon movie from Polanski we were edging around, it can't just be a plot element or the characters are cool or interesting or whatever. It has to be about that relationship. And with that in mind, even though we already spoiled it a little bit at the top of the show, I had to have Margaret and Carrie White from Brian De Palma's Carrie on my list. It's my number five. And as I was making my picks, I was thinking about trying to come up with a word or two that really defines those relationships. And the one that comes to mind when I think about their relationship is really dominance, unfortunately. You've got a mother there, and unfortunately this happens too often with some parent-child relationships where a mother is trying to enforce her will on her daughter and really make sure that she doesn't make the same mistake she did, and she's going about it in a completely misguided, improper way. But it even goes back to a little bit a fairly interesting part in the movie we reviewed this week, Stoker, where Nicole Kidman talks about why people have kids. And she talks about how it's almost as if maybe their goal is to try to start new and to put someone on this earth who they can mold and have them do everything right. They can get it right this time and not fall into some of the same traps. You certainly think that's where Margaret White is going with Carrie. She's going to keep her, most of all, from going to that prom.
Prom?
Yeah, senior prom, you know, everybody's going.
It's that teacher that called, wasn't it?
Please see that I'm not like you, Mom. I'm funny. I mean, all the kids think I'm funny. I don't want to be. I want to be normal. I want to start to try and be a whole person before it's too late for me to be. His name's Tommy Ross, and he's a very nice boy, Mom.
No.
And he promised to stop him and
leave
you before him. And my minute, Mom, I'm
no,
accepted,
no,
Mama.
No, no,
I accepted, Mama. I accepted.
Come to your closet.
No.
After all you've been taught,
everyone isn't bad, Mama. Everything isn't a sin.
Come to your closet and pray. Ask to be forgiven.
It's a campy film at times. There's no doubt about it. And maybe that's why I love that mother-daughter relationship so much. It's just so much fun, creepy fun, to watch those conversations together. You get the perfect lightning and thunder at the exact moment where she mentions the prom and those kind of touches from De Palma that are a little bit heavy-handed, but it's fun. It's fun in a really disturbing way, so they're my number five pairing.
Yeah, I do need to revisit Carrie, and it'll probably happen here because of the remake that's coming up, because my memories of it are of all the campy scenes.
Sure.
And so I want to look through it through a little older lens than I don't know how old I was when I saw it, but it's been quite a while. My number four are Ripley and Newt in Aliens. In James Cameron's sequel, Sigourney Weaver's Ripley reluctantly returns to planet LV-426. I have that memorized,
Adam. Nicely done. I'm so impressed.
In addition to Aliens, she finds there this lone little girl, Newt, who's played by Carrie Henn. I really think this is the stroke of genius of the screenplay. It's credited to Cameron, but was also worked on by David Giler and Walter Hill. Because if Alien established Ripley as this formidable force among manly men, that's one of the things that movie did, Aliens returns her to a sense of femininity by giving her this motherly mission of protecting Newt. Of course, this being James Cameron, who's never been afraid of strong female action heroines, she's still allowed to be this resilient, tough character. So it works within the story's action framework. Of course, I could include on this list, too, because there's that great touch that Ripley runs up against the alien queen who's protecting her eggs.
Right, so you get that crossover there.
Another mother-daughter relationship at play.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be so clever this week that I was going to include Aliens. I was going to cheat because, frankly, they're not really mother and daughter.
This was a surrogate relationship. Okay.
And I thought for sure that Mr. Fascist non-cheater here on the show with the top fives would never go for something like this. But there you are, making the case for Aliens. But Josh, I can't argue with you because it's my number four as well. And I think
Good.
You said it very well. I really don't know what else to add other than to say that what I love about that film is, you're right, it does surprise you. It adds a new element to Ripley's character. And by the end of the film, you're so invested in the survival of the characters because of that mother-daughter relationship. More than anything else, I remember feeling when I watched Aliens again fairly recently that I almost didn't completely care if Ripley didn't survive, but she had to keep Newt alive. And of course, I wanted them to be together. And in my perfect happy ending, they would be together. But I remember feeling like after bringing her through all of this, after her surviving that time on that planet alone and them developing this bond, at the very least, she's got to get her out alive, and there's got to be a rainbow here at the end of this grim story. So that is one reason why I love that relationship, but also it's what really makes the third film, which I know a lot of people don't want to talk about, and I totally get that, but that's the most frustrating thing about that movie. I watched them back to back, and after going through this ride with Ripley and Newt and getting so invested in their story and really wanting them to be mother and daughter for the rest of their lives together, you start the third movie, it picks up right where Aliens left off, and they land, and she's dead. There's no time given to it at all. I'm sorry, spoiler alert, at the start of Aliens 3, they've just cut that character out completely, and they just act as if everything you just saw in Aliens doesn't matter at all.
A little harsh.
I think Sigourney Weaver gets a little moment where she laments the fact that she just lost her daughter. But that's all she gets, and the movie goes on from there. And it's so depressing because Aliens was so successful. Now, if you've seen the movie years apart, the way they were made, it may not hit you that much. But you watch them close together, and it really makes you feel regret that they didn't do more with that storyline somehow in the third film. So I'm with you. I love that surrogate relationship. I think it does work for this list.
All right. Well, I participated in that cheat, and here's another one that could be breaking some rules. It's just all coming apart for me in this show here.
I love it.
It's the mothers and daughters, the varying mothers and daughters of Hairspray. In John Waters' 1988 musical comedy, which is about a 1960s teen dance show, there are actually three key mother-daughter relationships
at
play. If I have to pick one, you know, I'm going to pick Tracy Turnblad, played by a luminous Ricky Lake, and her mother Edna, who's played in drag by notorious Waters collaborator Divine.
Not John Travolta.
No.
Is in the remake. You're not going with the remake?
No. You know, I like the remake, but Travolta almost destroys it with his presence.
That.
Let's move back to the original. I think that Tracy's undeterred confidence, you know, famously she doesn't have the conventional Barbie look, but she has this confidence, and a huge part of that surely comes from the confidence that Divine has playing this mother figure. It somehow seeps into the fictional characters as well. Just the fact that he doesn't bother to hide his 5 o'clock shadow, you know, is so great. But there's also in this movie Tracy's best friend Penny, played by Leslie Ann Powers, and her mother, played by Joanne Havrila, and her mother's the one who locks her away after she begins this interracial romance. Then you get, even better, Amber and Velma von Tussle, who are the reigning Barbie mother and daughter in town. Mother Velma, of course, deliciously played by Debbie Harry.
Now it's time for you know what.
Mother, I know all the dances.
Come on, get up, get up.
Practice makes perfect. I ought to know. Don't forget, I was Miss Soft Crab in 1945, and that title wasn't handed to me on a silver platter. I worked for it. Now, come on. A one, two, three, pony!
So take your pick among the mother-daughter pairs in that group, Adam, but put together, Hairspray is my number three.
Yeah, it's one I completely overlooked, and I'm going to give you a pass, even though you mentioned 12 or so different characters, because that aspect of the film, that mother-daughter relationship, those relationships is so integral to that movie, and I like that movie quite a bit as well. My number three deals with at least one staunch woman.
S-T-A-U-N-C-H. There's nothing worse, I'm telling you. They don't weaken, no matter what. But they didn't know that. How would they know?
The woman I'm speaking of is Little Edie Bouvier Beale and her mother, Big Edie, from the Maisels Brothers classic documentary from 1975, Grey Gardens. And as I was thinking about aliens a little bit and the word that sort of defines these relationships, there's a dependency to Ripley and Newt, where we see in Ripley, she gets something out of this relationship with this girl as her surrogate daughter that maybe she even didn't know she needed. Clearly, Newt needs a mom basically just to survive. You go to the Beals in Grey Gardens, and there's a far less functional, much more weird and disturbing
a little bit
type of codependency that goes on between Big Edie and Little Edie. And you do have to wonder what really does keep them together. And that's what I think the Maisels are trying to explore, is not only what keeps them together, but what keeps them in this place, this crumbling facade that they're living in. They're trying to hang on to this old world notion of this aristocracy and the time when they were riding high as this important family. And that staunch scene is so funny because she says, you're dealing with a staunch character. And I know what Little Edie means there, of course, using the word character, but it speaks to another really fascinating aspect of the film, which is how Little Edie seems to be constantly playing some kind of character. Like, they're completely lost in this fantasy world. There is no grasp of reality at all. And another famous scene where she talks about the outfit she's wearing, she even calls it a costume. I think it's the best costume for today. And then it ends with that beautiful tagline that I'm guessing the Maisels behind the camera had to do a little bit of jumping up and down, either in the moment after she said it or in the editing room when they were watching it and they heard her say,
it's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present. Do you know what I mean? It's awfully difficult.
You know what I mean? It's awfully difficult. And that's really what this film is dealing with. And we see it play out in that mother-daughter relationship.
That's really interesting that you just referenced the filmmakers possibly jumping up and down when they had something good, because I'm so glad you put this on your list. I wanted to, but I really have a struggle with this movie in the fact that it's verging for me on being exploitative of them. And I know that so many of these personality-driven documentaries, that's the devil's bargain we make.
Right.
We're going to watch them because they're fascinating, often because they're weird. So it's a bit hypocritical of me to say, well, this one crosses the line. But I have to say, watching this movie, something didn't sit well for that aspect of it. And I think it has to do with that show business you're talking about, in that both Edies have had attempts at show business in their past, and they seem to be glomming onto the filmmakers as giving them another shot.
Yeah.
And
there's no doubt about it.
There's that sense of exploiting that desire of theirs, which isn't entirely rational. I mean, I would not dissuade anyone from seeing this movie because it is so fascinating. And what the filmmakers capture is really good stuff, but it's just one that makes me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I can see it, but I think that's part of what makes it such a famous documentary. I think you're really getting at one of the interesting layers of that film, because not only are they exploiting the characters, but the characters are exploiting the filmmakers in a way, or
that's
they
true.
Maybe think they are.
They think they are.
This is launching them to something, at least Little Edie. And if you've watched other Maisel's documentaries, I mean, they are so good at really getting at this disillusionment, this sense of the American dream gone by you, and the melancholy of that. And I think this film really gets that. I think Salesman is a better documentary from the Maisels, but I would definitely put Grey Gardens up there.
All right. My number two, Mildred and Vita in Mildred Pierce.
Great movie.
It takes guts to go up against Joan Crawford, but that's what Anne Blythe does as her daughter in Mildred Pierce. Crawford's Mildred, she really has no trouble standing up to men. I mean, much of the movie is about her establishing her independence after divorce, but she's almost helpless when it comes to her desire to please this social climbing and thankless, just totally thankless, older daughter. Fairly early on, while Vita is still only a teen, she despises the fact that her mother has had to take a job as a waitress and is already starting to conspire against her.
You've been snooping around ever since I got this job, trying to find out what it is. And now you know. You know, don't you?
Know what? Know what, Mother?
You knew when you gave that uniform to Lottie that it was mine, didn't you?
Your uniform?
Yes, I'm waiting tables in a downtown restaurant.
My mother.
I took the only job I could get so you and your sister could eat and have a place to sleep and some clothes on your backs.
Aren't the pies bad enough? Did you have to degrade us?
Vita, don't talk like that.
I'm really not surprised. You've never spoken of your people, who you came from, so perhaps it's natural. Maybe that's why Father...
Now, it gets much worse from there if you haven't seen the movie. Vita really starts as a snot and eventually turns into, well... I probably don't want to give it away, but it's pretty astonishing how harsh this mother-daughter relationship gets by the end.
Yeah, I guess it's fitting that after starting with Mommy Dearest, we would go to Mildred Pierce and Joan Crawford here for this list. I love that movie, and it's definitely an honorable mention for me. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five movie mother-daughters, and my number two comes from a film that was discussed in detail here on the show back in, I believe it was 2007, when its director, Ingmar Bergman, passed away. The film is Autumn Sonata, and the characters are Charlotte and Eva, though there's another sister, Helena, in the movie as well, who does play a central role. And this is the movie I teased earlier that had a piano connection. You've got Ingrid Bergman as Charlotte, and I want to say this was her last role, or at least her last notable role, and she's so good here in the movie. She is a famous concert pianist. She comes to visit that great Bergman collaborator, Liv Ullmann, as her eldest daughter, Eva, and she hasn't seen her in like 7 years. She's basically completely neglected her two daughters, including one who has some mental and physical problems, and she just put away in a home. And she comes to visit Eva and finds that Eva is there taking care of Helena. And over the course of her stay, a lot of those past skeletons come out, and they really get into the elements of their relationship that have been a problem over all these years. And you start to really understand how Charlotte has been such a self-centered, that's the word I kept coming back to with this relationship, has been so self-centered, and really someone who, unlike, say, Ripley or some of these other mothers that have made our lists, who have a natural instinct to be a mom, that's certainly going to apply to my number one, she just didn't have it. She was way too caught up in her life and her success. And so then when she has to confront the selflessness of her daughter now taking care of the other daughter, the one she completely neglected, that's where the real drama comes from. It's a really fascinating movie. It's a Bergman film. It's not light. It's pretty depressing, but a lot of reasons to see it, including not only that relationship, but the performances of Liv Ullmann and Ingrid Bergman.
Well, I'm going to stick with a foreign film for my number one, not quite a classic, though I hope someday it'll be considered this, because it is my favorite Pedro Almodovar film. You could pick a lot of his, probably, but my favorite is Volver, and the relationship of Raimunda and Irene certainly is key to this story. In some ways, this is sort of a variation on Mildred Pierce in that it's largely a melodrama, it involves murder, and has a main character who starts her own restaurant business. That just occurred to me when I was putting this together. That would be Penelope Cruz's Raimunda, who has a daughter of her own, and their relationship is a key part of the story too, but more crucial is her relationship with her own mother, who's played by Carmen Mora, and she returns to the story as a ghost. Now, this is a movie of all sorts of startling revelations, so I'll sort of leave the plot synopsis there. But Volver is really, you know, like so many of his films, it's about the delicate dynamics at play between sisters and mothers and daughters, all those sorts of relationships, mothers and daughters, especially here. In the end, it has this touching hope that if those relationships are strong enough, they may even be able to conquer death. That's sort of what the movie is getting at, which I guess, thinking about it, that makes it a little bit more uplifting than Mildred Pierce. So
yeah,
it definitely
just a
differs
bit
there.
I certainly thought about Pedro Almodovar and all his films with those great female relationships at their core, and Volver is one that almost made my list. It's an honorable mention for me, certainly a great pick.
Stella, I can't have our child living this way.
What's wrong this time?
It's not just this time. is every time I...
What do you mean? Because there was a couple of drinks? Well, what's wrong with that? Coming in here with that icebergy way of yours.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be rude. But she's my child, too, and I won't have this. I haven't wanted to take Laurel away from you, but if you...
Take her away from me? What are you talking about?
For my list and my number one, I go from the absolute self-centeredness of Ingrid Bergman in Autumn Sonata to the total selflessness of Stella and her daughter Laurel in Stella Dallas. This is a melodrama from 1937, directed by King Vidor. And Barbara Stanwyck, the great Barbara Stanwyck, plays Stella. She's a woman who is determined to rise up in society. She comes from really blue-collar means and isn't very sophisticated. She wants to better herself, and she meets a man who comes from higher society, though he's a little bit down on his luck, and manages to marry him, and they have a daughter, and she still wants to just go out and have a good time. She's not really someone who thinks she's cut out to be a mother. Lo and behold, she's actually really good at it, and it's all she thinks about, and she wants to raise Laurel the right way. And there's a whole lot of plot here I don't want to get into. Suffice it to say, at some point, there comes a moment of recognition on Stella's part that she's never going to be able to change who she is, or society won't allow her to change. She's been put in this box because of her upbringing and where she comes from that she can't escape from. And at the end of the film, she makes a decision that no parent would ever want to make. And I'm going to say 99.999% of us would never be able to make, because we would be thinking about ourselves too much. We would not be able to do this. But she puts her daughter's happiness above her own. And the closing sequence and the closing shot of Stella Dallas is so heartbreaking. I think this movie's made one top five list before, and I don't remember what we called it, but essentially movies that make me tear up a little bit. This is one of them. If you're a mom out there listening and you've never seen Stella Dallas and you watch it, I guarantee it will get very dusty in your living room as you watch this movie. I defy you not to get choked up watching Stella Dallas.
I'll have to put that to the test. Have not seen Stella Dallas.
Let me know when you have that experience. What about any other honorable mentions? We've certainly covered a lot of films, including ones at the top of the segment, but what were some other ones that were maybe really tough to leave off?
Yeah, I do have a few others, and these I recently mentioned on other lists, so they couldn't make this one in my mind. Coraline, top five doppelganger movies. Precious, top five dramatic performances by comic actors. Ugh, didn't really want to relive that relationship again, but it would fit. The Kids Are All Right, I thought about, but it's really more mother-children.
Yeah.
But then again, you have two mothers, so maybe that makes up for it.
Okay.
I don't know. I thought about that one. Mean Girls, Amy Poehler is so funny in that picture. And we referenced Deborah Winger. We heard from Deborah Winger. She had a very good mother performance in Rachel Getting Married.
Yeah,
about
that's
that
true.
One too.
Yeah, I think that's a good pick. We mentioned two of mine, and Mildred Pierce and Volver, that made your list. But also for me, Margaret, the film from a couple of years ago with Anna Paquin. That film, that relationship between the mother and daughter is so crucial to that movie. And also another piano angle. This is the third movie that's come up, if you count Stoker, that includes a mother and daughter and playing the piano. So I don't know what that says about really complicated relationships and maybe a certain rigidity, for lack of a better word, to them. But The Piano Teacher, Michael Haneke's film with Isabelle Huppert, who's always so good. And in that movie, the mother she lives with is simply called the mother. You got to think about that pairing when you consider your top five movie mother-daughter. So a few more titles we'll throw out there. We know there are many others, and we look forward to your feedback. You can email us anytime with any comments about the show, feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Opening in limited release here in Chicago, The ABCs of Death. It's a 26-chapter horror anthology. Don't Stop Believing, Every Man's Journey. This is a doc about the man who was picked from YouTube to replace Steve Perry, essentially become the lead singer of Journey.
Didn't Mark Wahlberg already make this movie?
Yeah,
there's
that's true.
There's a fiction version
bad
of
movie.
It.
Bad movie. Rock star. Emperor is out. This stars Tommy Lee Jones and Matthew Fox in a film about Japanese surrender at the end of World War II, and a new indie comedy with Nick Offerman from Parks and Rec fame, Somebody Up There Likes Me. In wide release, Dead Man Down. This is the film from the Swedish director of Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. It also stars Noomi Rapace. Oz the Great and Powerful, directed by Sam Raimi, starring James Franco, Michelle Williams, Mila Kunis, and Rachel Weisz. I love Sam's note here for us and other people who are not beautifully talented actresses.
That about sums it up.
It's got quite a few in that movie. Next week on the show, we will discuss Oz the Great and Powerful.
You're so excited about it.
I can't wait at all. And we're going to share our top five movie locations we wish we could visit.
fictional locations.
Yes. So totally fictional. They only are seen in the movies, places like Oz that you'd love to go visit. I mean, Oz really is the obvious choice there.
Got it. Yeah.
So that's,
I know where we're going.
That's where we're trying to go. And I haven't come up with a clever hashtag yet. What should the hashtag be, Josh, on Twitter?
Movie locations I wish I could visit.
Wow. That's
that
that's
leaves
a mouthful.
Us, what, about 20 characters?
Yeah. We're going to have to think about this a little bit more. We'll change that up.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured music this week was from Sharon Van Etten, came from her 2012 album Tramp. Learn more at SharonVanEtten.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
You're going to start it off. I'm going to give you the action.
All right.
And action.
They look like big good.
All right. Back it up a little bit.
Okay. I'll give you action. You're good.
Your head.
You're going to have to
just
speed it up.
Just stay still.
We can't.
This
we don't
is
have
how
all hours. We don't have all hours to do this scene.
Oh, it goes. I have to be true to the scenes.
Oh, okay. Starting now, verisimilitude matters. Okay, here we go. And action.